netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to speak with Hal Hickel, ILM's animation director for the movie Rango. Before we get to that, I just wanted to talk about some of the things we've been up to at FX Guide and FX PhD. Mike Seymour recently came to the United States for a little three-day whirlwind. The purpose of Mike's trip was to pick up a Red Epic M, one of the handmade early release epics being released into the wild. I would say probably the third or fourth one that was released that's not out actively on a production. Red's been hand-building these Epic M's in preparation for getting cameras out there into the wild for testing and for productions, in anticipation of the machined Epic X's coming out soon. It was a great day at Red. We spent about 3 hours going through the camera, testing out all the equipment. It was really great. And then we also got to spend some time with Jim Gennard, the founder of Red, and Jared at the Red headquarters in Hollywood. Really amazing to be there on the lot. The studio's just really going gangbusters. Busy, busy, busy place. Actually, while we were there, we got to hold a prototype of an Epic with a Canon lens mount, with control over the lens being done by the Red. Autofocus in particular is what we were looking at, and that was really just, there's no way to describe it. I've held the prototypes of the Epic, I've read all the specs, but actually holding it in your hand with a working LCD finder on it and watching the autofocus work, and even with a PL mount lens on that camera, just feeling this, that you can, you've got a camera capable of 5K with 120 frames a second, plus HDRX, their new HDR mode. It's truly hard to imagine. It's just a nice small package that you can build up to be a full production camera on a tripod or crane or whatever you want, with all the bells and whistles strapped on the back. But just be able to shoot something with the camera in this very basic configuration, 128 gig or 256 gig, I guess you can get, SSD drive mounted on the side, a little battery in the camera grip called the Volt battery, and you're ready to go. It's pretty amazing. A couple days after Mike got back to Australia with the camera, they shot some tests. If you want to head over to reduser.net, if you want to see some of this, follow along with the progress of testing this camera, go to reduser.net/forum, and then click on Epic M Owners, and you'll find one from Mike Seymour. And that's where you'll find a lot of stuff. We're also posting stuff over on FX PhD in the Dean's blog, as well as you'll see a lot of stuff on FX Guide in the coming weeks. The Epic is right now, as I record this, in New Zealand with Mike Seymour, John Montgomery, Jim Shen, and Stu Mashewitz. And they are filming for a solid week with a gear list that's hard to believe. I mean, they've got a gyroscope. They were just in a helicopter with the pilot who shot all the Lord of the Rings stuff. They just did a zip line in a forest. They're doing time lapses. And this is all part of FX PhD. Everything I'm talking about with the Epic, you're going to see a lot of this in FX PhD footage for students and also for testing. Over in the RC podcast, we'll also be covering it quite a bit. On the Twitter account, they posted after doing some tests with the HDR mode. This, I'm going to read this from the Twitter. Sick of hearing how amazing HDRX is? Let me just say this. It's like you're no longer shooting with a sensor. You're shooting with your eye. That just sums it up so well, because you're seeing something that you go, wait, that's not possible, but that's how I would see it if I was looking at it. This dynamic range capability is going to be something that, imagine it for things like car shots, where you're shooting inside a car with very low light, minimal light inside the car, and then you're always fighting, trying to balance that outside light. Well, if you could hold 3 to 6 stops of extra latitude, you got to solve that problem and come up with some really amazing footage. All right, well, let's get back to the subject of our podcast, and that's Rango. Here in the United States, it surpassed the Green Hornet this first weekend with $38.1 million, making it the top grossing opening film so far in 2011. This is an interesting film because it's the first feature film animation done completely by ILM. So let's talk now with Hal Hickel, ILM's animation director for Rango.
So first, let me start by saying thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Sure, absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
I've seen the film, and my kids saw the film separately, actually, at a second screening. And I guess my question is, when you were approaching the project, were you aiming for me or my kids?
Both. Both. Although probably not. I don't know how old your kids are. Probably not for really little kids. You know, it is rated PG. So it's, you know, it's aimed at, for instance, my son's 10, and he really, really enjoyed it. And I think probably 10 and up. And it's not so much that there's stuff in there that's horribly inappropriate for kids younger than that, I guess depending on your perspective on what's inappropriate. But it's just that I think the general aim in terms of, you know, the sweet spot was probably for kids older than that and up into, you know, grown-ups.
Yeah, my kids were 9 and 12, and they thought it was really good. And interestingly, they were really pleased by the kind of quirkiness of it. And I guess that's one of the points I wanted to pick up with you about the project. And we'll, if I could, I'll come back to it. But because I think it is really interesting that this isn't necessarily lovely, cuddly, soft, plush toy type characters.
Absolutely, yeah.
But let's just start with the project itself, because obviously ILM, huge history, but this is really the first full animated film. There was talk of other things like Frankenstein in the past. Why now?
I think the easy and the simplest answer is Gore Verbinski. We'd done the three Pirates films with him, and while we were making the second and third film along the way, he kind of mentioned that, you know, he kind of wanted to do an animated film, and we didn't at that time really know what it would be about or anything. But when he came to us, I think John Knoll and I got phone calls, our first phone calls around August, the end of August 2007, I think, because it was around when SIGGRAPH was that year, which I think was down in San Diego that year. I remember John stopping me on the show floor, and he had heard from Gore, and I hadn't yet. But, you know, he brought us this project, and because of our relationship with him, you know, I was excited about it before I even knew anything about it. But then once we kind of got the download from Gore on what his vision for the project was, it became clear pretty quickly that it was a great fit for us, even outside of our relationship with him, because it melded two things that we already, you know, felt like we did well. It was going to be a hand-animated film, and we've had a history of doing character animation at ILM since day one, you know, going back to Phil Tippett and John Berg animating the chess characters and the holographic chess characters in the first Star Wars, and, you know, segueing into computer animation in the 80s and, you know, all the way through Jurassic Park and Davy Jones and everything else up till today. So that's always been a big part of our DNA, I guess you'd say. And then he wanted this really gritty, tactile, I don't want to say realistic, but highly detailed look to the film. And so you kind of put those two things together, and it just made it a really perfect project for us. I think if a director had come in with a much more broadly cartoony kind of project, you know, it wouldn't have been as good a fit for us.
Yeah, it was an interesting choice, because while you obviously are very skilled at hand animation, you've also had some really major technical breakthroughs in motion capture.
Mm-hmm.
And at the core of this film was this technique of kind of emotion capture. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I should be clear. It wasn't a technical process. It was more just a...
I think that's what I like about it, actually.
Yeah.
I like about it.
It was a creative process, and it really just stemmed from the fact that Gore was a live-action director. And, you know, when people said to him, well, when you make an animated movie, you're going to want to bring the actors in one at a time and record them separately in the sound booth. And to him, that just sounded crazy. He's like, no, I've got to have my actors together. I got to have them reacting to each other, bouncing off each other. I want to set up a shoot and just, you know, we won't do it quite like a regular live-action film, but we'll do it faster than that. But I need to have them together, and that made sense to us too. We just thought, yeah, that sounds like a great way to get kind of a different sound from the reeds. You know, really get them bouncing off each other, get a more live kind of feel to it. So that's where it started. And then as we talked about that, we thought, well, you know what, we can film all this, and that'll give us a leg up when we start animating. And it wasn't really intended as a blueprint or a roadmap for the performances for the animators to work from, but it was a resource that they could mine for bits of business and that sort of thing. And so, you know, for a lot of reasons, it just made sense to us to do it that way. And somewhere along the way, it was dubbed emotion capture. But it ended up being a great thing in a lot of ways for us.
Because there are lots of things like bits of business and what characters do when they're not delivering lines that
right.
I think are really interesting for an animator. And I think there's probably a lot, a not or a lack of credit given to good animation for the character that isn't giving the line, if that makes sense. The way that they can both not distract you but also give a performance because the story is playing out as that character reacts to what's being said. And presumably that was helpful because you actually had them reacting to each other.
Yeah, no, it was hugely helpful. I mean, and Gore's a really, it's funny, you mentioned something that I remember him talking about often while we were making the film, that idea of looking at the characters who are not the center of attention and making sure that they're in the moment and they're reacting. And, you know, that sounds sort of self-evident in terms of just acting in general and making sure that the, you know, performances are convincing, but it's not always something that I think the animators are thinking of. They tend to want to concentrate on the character who's talking and not as much on the characters that are listening. And Gore was always very sensitive to that. He was always, you know, urging us to keep an eye on the other characters. And the footage that we got from those sessions did help with that. It was also great for weird little things like reaction shots, which can be surprisingly tough. You know, you don't think that much about them, but when you sort of cut to the crowd and you're looking for a particular kind of take, there's so many ways you can go with it that it's almost like you become paralyzed from having too many options and having stuff to look at to sort of give us ideas and point us in certain directions was helpful. The other thing too is just that, you know, you get a great sort of singular feel for a character when, at least at the outset, it kind of springs from a single actor's mind. Like, for instance, Johnny or Bill Nighy, who makes such quirky choices that are really unique to him and singular. And, you know, because each character in the movie isn't animated by one single animator all the time, you know, there's different animators who work on a character over the course of a film, it's nice that at the very beginning of the acting process for a character, there was sort of a single mind kind of throwing out ideas and setting a kind of tone, and I think that helped as well. I think that was a good thing to have.
The characters are, as I said earlier, not really cuddly. They are, in fact, fabulous for their detail, and you kind of you can't take your eye off of them. But they are really, there's a point when I was watching it, I looked around the screen, I sort of took myself out of the film deliberately, and I said, there's nothing in this shot that's pretty. There's like literally nothing that screams, for want of a better term, Disney.
Right.
Was it always that gritty and that, I mean, visually interesting, just not very soft and cuddly?
Yeah. I mean, I think it sprang it ended up that way for a couple of reasons. One, it sprang out of the kind of story that the film was right from the outset. It was a Western with an aim towards having a lot of the feel of, for instance, Once Upon a Time in the West or any of the other, you know, sort of classic spaghetti Westerns, whereas, you know, where we want to have the characters feeling sweaty and dirty and gritty and to have all that kind of texture and dusty feel to everything. So it sprang out of that, but it also came from the fact that no one in the sort of very small creative nucleus that this film sprang out of. You know, this film wasn't the product of, you know, four different directors and three different story teams and a parade of writers. It was Gore Verbinski and Jim Burkett and Crash McCreary. And then, you know, and the next ring out from that would be, you know, Tim and I and John Knoll and, you know, the creative folks here at ILM, our art director, John Bell, and it sort of went out from there. But at the center, it was, you know, a really small nucleus of creative folks, and none of them were cartoonists. You know, there wasn't anybody on board who was from that world. And, you know, cartoon, creating really effective cartoons is an art form unto itself, clearly. That concept of sort of stripping things down to their essence and creating a really kind of graphic, bold, punchy read with a lot of appeal. There's a lot of emphasis placed on appeal, the concept of appeal in cartoon animation, mainstream cartoon animation. none of us came from that background, and none of us gravitated toward that. As an animator, I love to see that when it's done well. I mean, I used to work at Pixar. I love Pixar, and I'll see all their films, and I love them. But we just, as filmmakers, that wasn't the style we wanted to go towards. And the thing is that because none of us came from that world, we didn't see an animated film as... I think some folks see an animated film as kind of a genre unto itself that is cartoons. And we were like, well, no, animation could be anything. It's just a technique. And that's not the direction we want to go. That direction is already very crowded with very competent, highly skilled people. And we want to strike off in this other direction over here that looks a lot less crowded. In fact, we don't see anybody standing over there. So we're gonna go over here and try and do this other thing that's sort of photo surreal with... you know, a kind of reality to it, but still with very highly stylized characters and, but with a super tactile feel. I mean, we definitely wanted everything in the film. If you saw a character up close, you could immediately imagine what it would feel like to put your hand on that character's shoulder or what their breath would smell like if they breathed on you or whatever. But, you know, we wanted things to feel real in that way, as bizarre as they were. So all those things just kind of drove it in that direction. And, you know, there were definitely times, I mean, Rango himself is a huge risk. You know, if you look at the eyes of characters from all of the big animated films of the last 15 years since Toy Story came out, you know, since CG animations come to the fore, you know, you'll see that almost every one of them have great big oversized ping pong ball eyes with a very punchy graphic iris, you know, and that's a great, it's a great read. It's very clear, you know, emoting with eyes like that is very clear. And you get a great read of the eye line and everything. And, you know, we've got a character who's got great big eyes, but they're almost entirely covered with flesh. And that just, you know, Gore and Crash had settled on the idea of a chameleon, and they'd gone and looked at chameleons, and they loved those wrinkly, baggy eyes. And we... worried about it. I know I did at the beginning. At the outset, I thought, wow, you know, this is cool, but he's our hero, and is this going to kind of cut people off from him and not let them empathize with him? But as soon as we started to kind of move him and animate him, we realized that those wrinkles, those concentric sort of wrinkles around his eyes, really were an opportunity for expression rather than a barrier. And so we just really got into it and tried to make the most of them. And, you know, they ended up being great, but it was definitely risky. And all the characters are kind of like that. There's a few. Priscilla and Waffles, who's the little spiky lizard, they're pretty appealing just right out of the bag. And the mariachi owls. But a lot of the others are... you know, a mixed bag in terms of classical concept of appeal in an animated character. And some of them are downright repellent. I mean, Baltazar, who's the head bank robber, we call him Pappy in the film, you know, he's kind of a mix of a naked mole rat and Harry Dean Stanton. And, you know, it's a pretty freaky looking character. So, yeah, we took some chances there.
I love that mariachi owl band, by the way. Just all-time favorite. it's funny. There's actually, I guess, a precedence for a chorus going back to the Greek days.
And sure.
It just seems to work so well in that production. Let me ask you though about the eyes, because it seemed, I think I've heard somewhere on the grapevine that come some of the secondary characters and that had bigger eyes, that you sort of worked out eye lines and stuff in kind of a low res, but then you actually had to develop quite far along to get those eyes just right in terms of refraction and how they actually looked, because they are obviously central to the performance.
Yeah, we, you know, possibly unwisely decided early on that we wanted to have real corneas on the eyes that would really refract the light. And because we looked at a lot of eyes of animated characters we'd seen, and it looked to us like pretty uniformly they didn't really do that. The irises were kind of just painted on the surface of the eyeball. And there might be some kind of shader trick to get a kick off the iris to sort of give it the illusion that it had a cornea there over it to kind of refract the light. But it didn't look to us like they were really doing it. And we thought we could bring a lot of depth to the characters. You know, you look at Priscilla's eyes and you really feel like there's a, you know, that outer shell and then just a deepness in that goes back into where those kind of iridescent irises and everything. So we did that, but you know, we soon realized why people don't do that. I mean, aside from the hit you get in rendering for having to render eyes like that, which is not a major concern, but you know, over the life of a whole film, I guess you have to take that into consideration. But the main thing is just that the refraction wasn't something the animators could see, because that wasn't, you know, obviously at an interactive level when they're animating, that it's not being rendered with refraction. And so, you know, an eye line is such a sensitive thing when you're doing just a conversation between two characters and you're cutting back and forth. If the eye line isn't just exactly right, it looks weird. And so we were finding that, you know, we'd animate a scene and get it approved, and then weeks later it would be in lighting, and we'd go, boy, his eye line just looks weird. And we'd compare the fully rendered version with the anim version and realize that the pupil was in a slightly different position because of the refraction. So we had to come up with some tools where we had a deformer in Maya that the animators could see the actual effect that refraction was going to have on the pupil. And it was just a deformer around the eyeball to solve that problem, so we could see ahead of time. I think going forward, I would either implement that or maybe even look at maybe if there's ways to just you know, cheat the appearance of refraction. I'm not sure which is a better solution, but in any case, it turned into a big headache for us. But I'm glad we did it, because the eyes have this great, really great look to them because of the refraction.
And can I ask you a question about the performance? Like, on a traditional, and I mean no disrespect to anyone at Pixar, but like a traditional Pixar thing, somebody delivers a performance. Now, in the quick making of, you see some actor film delivering a line or two, and then you see side by side their final performance on the screen. But there's a big step that's normally missed, which is that someone sits down with that recorded dialogue and edits almost word by word to get a final delivery out. That's right. The one that the animators use. But in your case, if you were doing multiple performances with multiple actors, this ability to chop and change individual words from multiple takes of dialogue would, I imagine, be either impossible or considerably less of an option. Were you sort of taking entire lines, or was it a case of really like editing the bajillicans out of the audio before you started animating?
It depended on the scene. And to be honest, I think that's something that they discovered once they were in editorial after the recording sessions. They kind of, I mean, we knew ahead of time that was something we were going to be giving up, the flexibility to just do anything with any line, since we weren't getting them all clean from one another. And they knew that going in. But Gore was sort of used to that, and just coming from a live action background, once again, he's sort of like, well, you know, yeah, sometimes we'll ask an actor to read the line wild if we think for any reason we might need to cut it up. And so he would do that from time to time during our recording process if he thought he might need it. So he sort of had that in mind, whereas I think, you know, traditional and animated films, they have that very much in mind. They record everything clean, I suppose primarily for that reason, also because I suppose it's easier to schedule your voice talent. You can just bring them in for 3 days and they get all their lines out of the way in one go. So they were still able to do that, but as you said, not nearly as much as you might otherwise if the actors are talking over each other. So I think that helped. I mean, it definitely contributed to the sound. I'm not sure it affected the animators' work all that much, because I'm not sure we were really necessarily aware of when a line had been chopped up version versus maybe when we were just getting sort of an actual read. And the only way we would know that is that in addition to, you know, out of those sessions came all this footage, right, of the actors, and Gore would sit with his editor and they would cut together sort of a best of reel for a given sequence, and they would turn that over to us when he turned over the sequence, and we'd sit and watch it all and talk about what was useful and what wasn't and what he liked about each sort of little piece of it. But in addition to that, we would get a reel that was the video that corresponded to the actual hero audio for each shot. And so if that audio had been sliced and diced, the video would be sliced and diced as well. It was kind of fascinating to watch, because you'd see them popping between different takes and everything, and it was kind of interesting. But the reason they gave us that footage was just a sanity check for lip sync. It was just so that we could really look and say, you know, okay, his lips have come together on this letter. And it wasn't to ape the actual mouth shapes of the actor, because our characters are so weird looking that there was never a correspondence there. But it was just mechanically to say, you know, the lips part on this frame, they press together on this frame, they pop open on this frame, etc. So because of that footage, we often could tell exactly how much the line had either been monkeyed with or not. But I don't know that it really affected the animator's approach. I mean, I think you just kind of forget that and listen to it and think about what its place in the shot is and what the shot's place in the sequence is and the sequence's place in the film, and just kind of go from there.
Let me ask you about something else just in terms of staging. I was really impressed when I started watching the film, though I didn't know I was being impressed. Well, I started watching the film and I thought, oh, that sky doesn't look particularly deep. It sort of surprised me a bit. And then, of course, I realized that that's exactly what you intended because he was inside the tank and the joke was on me, which made me want to go back and watch it again to try and work out how it was that you'd tricked me into thinking that in the first place. But that idea of scale, you played strongly there. Obviously, then some of the props and stuff were bigger once they're in the town. But it felt like you didn't really necessarily want to keep doing size gags. That once we got into the town, they were the size they were, and the framing and everything was just blocked as if for a Western. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah. There was a couple of things. To take your first comment about the terrarium, there was actually an idea originally to play that sequence even more kind of to sort of dial back on the realism even of Rango's textures and things, just to make everything feel more artificial as a kind of sucker punch for the audience to get them to thinking that this was going to be, you know, a kind of a CG animation like they might be used to seeing at maybe the lower end of things. I mean, not to make it look totally cheap, but definitely not to have it really be super textured, so that when the terrarium shatters, then it's like, boom, this is the world you're going to be in for the rest of the film. We backed off on that quite a bit. We made sure that in the opening scenes, Rango has his full look that he's going to have in the rest of the film. And, you know, the terrarium, if you get in close on things, even Mr. Tim's or any of it, they're fully detailed. They have scratches and scuffs and dirt and so forth. But overall, the look is pretty simple, because just by virtue of the fact that there's not much going on in the terrarium. There's the painted backing, there's the gravel and plastic palm tree, et cetera. So we kind of kept that idea, but just didn't hit it as hard as was originally intended. But I'm glad to hear that, you know, you did kind of go into it thinking, well, you know, that sky looks a little flat, but okay, you know. And then, oh, okay, that wasn't really a sky. So that's nice to hear that that still worked on some level. What was your next...
Well, then I was just saying the idea of scale, because when it felt like it was blocked for like a Western, not
absolutely.
A scale gag.
Really, he's supposed to be, what, 6 inches tall or whatever. So is this whole movie going to be lensed that way? Shallow depth of field, you know, as if it's a full-size camera, 2 inches off the ground, trying to frame up things, or not? And Gore pretty quickly said, I don't want to do that. Once this movie becomes a Western, I want to treat it as if he's 6 feet tall and we're, you know, with that kind of depth of field, that kind of photographic feel. So we had to sort of decide at the outset how to transition, because clearly once the terrarium smashes on the road, there's a lot of scale cues there telling us that he's 6 inches tall. He's out on this road. We kind of know how wide a two-lane road is and the stripe down the middle and so forth. So for that whole section where he talks to Roadkill, the armadillo, and all that, we did play it kind of like he's a little guy. I mean, it's not super shallow depth of field, but, you know, we played it about like if you were out on a road and you were framing up on a 6-inch tall lizard. Then once he wanders into the desert, that's when it changes. And there's a few mixed messages when he's being chased by the hawk in the desert, in terms of the size of the big saguaro cactuses. And of course, obviously he climbs into a soda bottle and things like that. But the desert around him, the dirt, that's where we start to get into just treating it like, in terms of the scale of sort of the rocks and the texture of the ground and so forth, and scrub brush and things around him, we start sort of suggesting that he's sort of human-sized, and that's what it's going to be for the rest of the film. And by the time you get to Beans and her wagon and the javelina, then it's really becoming a full-on sort of you know, when it's not a miniature world anymore.
Because this isn't even just a camera blocking problem, is it? Because it's also like cloth sims. Like, do I cloth sim for scale of cloth that was adult person cloth cut down for 6 inches, or is it the weave textured to the scale of the character kind of stuff?
Exactly.
Implications to this.
And, you know, we didn't, definitely once we started showing more and more characters, there, the only violation of it is that the town itself is made up in part by human scale cast-offs, like the jug that's the cantina and the gas can that's the saloon and some other things like that. But even that is kind of secondary to it just looking like an old west town. It's a neat idea, but there was pretty quickly it was decided not to get too precious with it. They didn't want it to be like The Borrowers or something, where absolutely everything there, you know, the wagon is an old matchbox and the wheels are, you know, thread spools, and, you know, it was like, no, it's a western town, and, you know, these characters can have 6 guns, and we're not going to worry about, well, how did they make a little tiny 6-gun, and what did they make it out of? You know, we just, it's like, it's a western. They're going to have these things, and we're not going to worry about where they came from.
Actually, Al had an electric guitar at one stage.
I mean, yeah, the Ponderay guitar. So Joey Ramone guitar. It pretty quickly we just sort of tried to do away with worrying about those things. And, you know, I don't know how successful that was. I've only seen one reviewer comment on the fact that there didn't seem to be much attention paid to the relative scale of the animals, which I thought was a funny thing to comment on. But we didn't pay any attention to that. I mean, there's, you know, one of the characters is a cat, and one of them is a lizard, and one of them is a rabbit, and they're all kind of the same size and bipedal. So, you know, at no point was like, well, we better scale that character up because that's not how big a, you know, a chameleon is next to a Gila monster or whatever. It's like, forget it. These are human characters. And that was kind of important anyways, that, for instance, Doc, Stephen Root's character, well, he plays two characters. He plays Mary Mac, the banker, and Doc, who's the town doctor. But Doc he's a town doctor and one of the town drunks. He's a drunk at the bar anyways. And that's really who he is in the film. That's the function he fulfills. He's the old western town doctor. The fact that he's a rabbit is a design motif, as the sort of animal aspects are with any of the characters. But you're never going to see him munching a carrot and sort of hopping along on 2 feet. That's not the movie we were making. And we talked about that early on. We were like, well, should Rango occasionally sort of get down on 4 legs and scamper around? You know, can he climb things extra? Does he use his tail on a prehensile way and stuff? And, you know, in general, we shied away from that kind of stuff. It's a, you know, he's Don Knotts mixed with Hunter S. Thompson, and, you know, that's who he is. But he's a lizard, so.
So you've won Oscars for films that are incredibly effects heavy. I mean, ILM, you know, no matter how great, obviously, we know your character animation team is an effects house when it's sort of has its DNA. And so this film shows that DNA because there are just awesome effects animation stuff intermingled with the character animation. And I guess I'm leading to ask you, was it kind of a luxury just to be able to basically stick anything anywhere, anyhow? Because, I mean, there's no way that you'd have been limited by, well, we don't have a good, sim for dust or water or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually a really great sort of cultural change for all the departments of this thing of not being tied to, for instance, a live action plate of, you know, which is, you know, I think a lot of people get into effects. I was an animator at Pixar 15 years ago on the first Toy Story, but I left there and came to ILM because I liked the idea of making things that aren't real, but then grafting them into real footage and trying to make that look as real as possible. That whole problem is interesting to me. But this film doesn't have any of that. There's no issues of integration. And so being freed from that was really a culture change for everyone. I think one of the departments that affected the most was layout, for instance. Our layout group typically is charged with taking live action footage and, you know, matching the camera, the virtual cameras to the real ones. And here there is no real footage. So the layout group became a whole creative process that we really hadn't done before. We'd done a little bit occasionally if we were, for instance, doing heavy previs on a show. But as a department over on a project this size, we'd never done anything like this. And so having them work with Gore to, you know, take the sequences from a two-dimensional animatic stage into the 3D world, but as a creative process of lensing the scenes and composing them, you know, that was a whole new thing for everybody. And the animators had to, you know, get used to the idea that there wasn't going to be this framework of the live action plate telling them, okay, you know, the explosion happens on frame 12 and the dinosaur reacts and he runs over here and he grabs that live action extra, and then you're going to transition to a digital double in its mouth and that all has to line up. And, you know, there weren't any of those kind of drivers to each scene. And there were other drivers, like, of course, you had the animatic, you had the audio you were given, you had direction from the director, but in general, there was just a lot more freedom, a much more of a blank slate to kind of jump in and be creative. And so that was, it's super exciting, but it's, you know, it's a lot of work. And work in a different way, you know, because while we are suddenly freed from all the work of integrating things and making sure. Also, I think the barrier of realism is lower. You know, you're trading that off with, you know, having more responsibility for instance, acting. You know, whether one's harder than the other is a whole other question. But it just, you know, it was a new. Everyone's exercising new muscles, I should say. So that was, you know, that was really exciting for everybody.
So the other obvious thing that you lose when you move from one to the other is you lose a DOP. I mean, a DOP sets an agenda for a film, and even if you're doing visual effects work and everything else, there's still an underlying initial DOP vision, if you like.
Absolutely.
Did you do anything there to centralize the vision of a DOP? In other words, was it a committee or was it one person that was sort of giving that initial direction? Was that you? I mean, how did that work?
Oh, no. First and foremost, it's Gore. He's a really camera-savvy director, and I mean that both in terms of composition and lensing, but also in terms of color and contrast and all those things. He's got a very clear vision that way. That said, you know, he is used to working with a director of photography. Roger Deakins was brought in on a consulting basis. He wasn't here day in and day out, but he would, lighting work would happen here, and then they would sort of pass it by Roger and get Roger's feedback, and then Roger's feedback would go to Gore, and then Tim Alexander or John Knoll, whoever was supervising the sequence, would then discuss it with Gore, and they'd move on. But
Roger Deakins has done that before, but I'm wondering how... So obviously he knows what he's doing, but oh my God, he knows what he's doing. But anyway, how is he giving that feedback? Is he giving that feedback in computer terms or traditional terms? Like, is he saying,
traditional terms.
Right.
I mean, he did come here and he sat with artists a few times, just, you know, in an interactive sort of way in order to lock in. That was at a very early stage where they sort of thought it was valuable to sort of have a piece of work that they could just interactively kind of mess with to kind of come to a common agreement about. But I think in general, it was about, you know, Tim and John sending him stuff and him just giving notes on it in pretty traditional terms, you know, like, I think this could be contrast here. I think your key could be further around this way. I don't think there's enough of a, you know, I think you've got too much fill, you know, that sort of thing, rather than it being anything in computer graphics terms. It was all just in camera and lighting sort of terminology, I think.
So moving forward, what would be the lesson you would take into the next fully animated film, given that you had this freedom that you were neither making the stuff to live action, nor were you making something that was like from a traditional, it wasn't like an adapted look that you were coming off a storybook or a thing that we already had in our heads as to what it looked like.
Yeah.
Is there anything you'd take forward to the next project?
We learned lots of little lessons along the way. Well, little and big, but I'm trying to think what is like sort of major takeaway. I mean, I definitely think the way we recorded the audio is something we would do again. That was, I think we all felt like that was a win. We liked that. That was a real benefit to us. We learned a ton about how to set up a layout group. We had hired, that was one area, because, you know, a lot of areas on this film, I think it ended up being an asset for us that none of us had made an animated feature before. I think that was actually an asset because we were able to kind of leverage what we did know how to do and bring new ideas. And we weren't sort of hampered by whatever it is, however it is people say you're supposed to do it. That said, you know, our DPS, our digital pipeline supervisor, Mike Bauer, he had worked on some animated features at DreamWorks. And also we hired, when we started to understand what our layout group needed, we went out and recruited someone who had done that on animated features before, and that was Nick Walker. And we knew that was one area that we needed to learn from folks who had done that over and over again, because layout is a real hub for a lot of things. It's where all your assets really start to kind of meet and get put together with sort of initial set dressing and stuff before it goes to anim. So those two were areas, layout specifically was an area that was a big learning process for us, and one where we really needed to learn from the folks that had been doing it over and over again on animated features. Whereas in the other areas, I think we felt like our relative inexperience in with animated features ended up being kind of an asset in terms of making a film that didn't feel like other animated films. It's not about making movies in a better way or anything like that, just doing it differently, I think was a good thing for us.
One final question on that.
Okay, go ahead.
Because the characters were so distinctive and they were completely, obviously they referred to an original performance, but they weren't, you know, targeted in a motion capture sense. Did you give the individual animators some like dummy scenes to just get to know their characters? Or, I mean, did they just launch into, okay, my first shot is he walks into the bar?
We would like to have. We talked a lot at the beginning about, we're going to do animated tests with all our main characters and really flesh out their who they are. And of course that pretty quickly went by the wayside. We were able to do that with Rango and a little bit with Priscilla, but pretty much everybody else, we just kind of had to get them into scenes and figure it out as we went along. And some characters dropped right in, like Priscilla. Pretty much, she looked great. She was her character, Virginie Danneville was our lead on Priscilla, and she just zeroed in on it right away. She looked great. Other characters like the mariachis, as appealing as they are, there was a tendency that for the animators to animate them in a very cute kind of way, like the way they were playing their instruments, were very bouncy, and that we had to really just kind of beat out of them, because we wanted them, Gore and I, you know, talked about how they really needed to have that kind of serious, proud demeanor that mariachi musicians generally have. You know, they're not cute. They're proud of what they do. They're good musicians. They're serious, and they're there to play. And in this case, they're here to sing about the hero. And we didn't want them looking like they were there for a birthday party or something. So,
well, also, actually, for the first part of the film, they're singing about the hero dying.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even like perky delivery. I mean, in terms of the story, they weren't like, you know, there to pepper things up. That was always telling us, well, this is the character and he's about to die.
Yeah,
which I always thought was great.
Exactly. And, you know, what's another one? The mayor took a while to get just right. And we had a great foundation for him. You know, he's based design-wise a lot on, and even performance-wise on the character that John Huston played in Chinatown, Noah Cross. And so we had great footage of that. But it's just once we started animating him, it just took us a while to really find him. And, there were just some discoveries along the way that, for instance, there was kind of an asymmetrical smile of his that really started to sell it with him. Just little things like that, that we kind of, as we worked on him, we're like, okay, that started feeling like, and then we had to go back and revisit some shots to really kind of get it all to feel the same. But he was a character that took a little while to sort of, you know, find him. And he's a great design right from the beginning. But, you know, one of the things we found with him, actually, we'd animated some shots, and then we started to get him the lighting and see what they look like. And his shirt just looked kind of rumpled and grubby. And, you know, most of the characters in the film look rumpled and grubby, but on him, it just had the wrong effect. He ceased looking like this man of power and just started to look like, you know, some old guy in a rest home. And so we went back and looked again at Chinatown and thought about it. And one of the things we noticed on the Noah Cross character is that he's got this fine embroidery on his shirt. And also his shirt is pretty crisply pressed, and ours wasn't. And so we went back and remodeled the collar and the cuffs and things, and then some of the sim parameters, and we added this kind of embroidery to the shirt and stuff. And it just made him look a little bit more sort of the man of power, the mayor. And sort of little things like that that just had to be discovered along the way. I think all the characters had that to some extent.
Well, look, I'm going to have to finish with just one question because it just killed me in the film. Did you actually approach Clint Eastwood, or was I'm sorry, I just have to ask.
No,
I know that's
okay.
A dorky question, but
no.
It was so funny in the film, and I was kind of gobsmacked.
My understanding is that they never did, and I don't know for sure. My sense is that they figured, look, here's a guy who's 85 or however old Clint is now. He makes two movies a year, at least. He doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want to do. And I think their worry was that if they went in and requested it and he said no, that might even lead to a request that they not use any sort of form of his image or something. I don't know what the thinking was. I think they just worried that it might lead to difficulty if it was presented and rejected. And so I think they just immediately started thinking, let's look around. And Timothy Oliphant does such a great Clint that, I think that was a pretty good solution. But
I must admit, I had to check the credits to see if it was Clint or not. And of course, my wife and kids just assumed it was Clint Eastwood. And I don't think my kids really, but my wife definitely was like, yeah, it was. And I was like, no, if you look in the credits. But it was a very funny part of the film.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's such an odd left turn. I mean, it makes sense in the film. It's not random, but it is such a surprising. Yeah, I love that.
Also because you've got that whole Vegas thing happening, it wasn't like as if it was detached from, it wasn't like from a different film. It was, the realization that they were on the edge of Vegas sort of allowed that, I think, to a certain extent. Gave you permission to go there.
Yep.
Well, look, thank you so much for talking to us. Sorry to ask you dorky questions, but it's been a joy talking to you.
No, absolutely. I enjoyed it as well. Thanks very much.
All right, well, thanks to Hal Hickel and to Mike Seymour for that interview. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you check out FX PhD and FX Guide for more about the Epic M. Well, that'll do it. Till the next FX Podcast, I'm Jeff Huser. For my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.